Random House Audio presents Fredericksburg and Chancellorsville, a guided tour from Jeff Shara's Civil War Battlefields, What Happened, Why It Matters, and What to See, by Jeff Shara, read for you by Robertson Dean. Fredericksburg and Chancellorsville. Though the battles of Fredericksburg and Chancellorsville are distinctly separate events, they are linked in several important ways. For purposes of this book, their proximity alone is a strong enough link. The two battlefields are less than 10 miles apart, and the National Park Service tours typically encompass both. They are linked as well historically by the cast of characters and by the fact that the Battle of Chancellorsville would not have occurred at all if the Federal Army had not experienced such a disaster at Fredericksburg. Fredericksburg, Virginia, December 11th to 14th, 1862. What happened here? From the beginning of the war, the Union commanders had been blessed with greater manpower and better equipment than their enemy, and had succeeded in choking off the South's trade with Europe. Thus, by anyone's measure, the North should have been the inevitable victor in this conflict. In the Western theater of the war, events had been reasonably positive for the Union, which by late 1862 had seized control of most of the primary river routes and had bested the Confederate forces in several major fights. But in the East, mainly Virginia, all the material advantages enjoyed by the Federal Army had been squandered by the astounding lack of effective leadership. To give credit where it's due, the Southern generals had, for the most part, been far more flexible and far more efficient in the field. Despite Jefferson Davis's need to put his finger into the plans of every major campaign, what would today be called micromanaging, Robert E. Lee had proven to be a superior tactician to his opponents. His primary subordinates, Jackson and Longstreet, as well as cavalry commander James Ewell Brown, Jeb Stuart, had outdueled their adversaries at nearly every opportunity. Lincoln's frustration with McClellan had come from McClellan's mistakes in battle, certainly, but also from McClellan's tendency to ignore the president's wishes. By replacing McClellan with Ambrose Burnside, the Union leadership in Washington believed they now had a commander who would at least obey orders. Whether or not Burnside was the right man to lead the Army of the Potomac was a matter to be decided later. In early November 1862, Lee had divided his army yet again. Jackson was at Winchester, at the northern end of the Shenandoah Valley, guarding against a sudden assault into Virginia's vulnerable breadbasket. Longstreet stayed closer to the primary rail lines at Culpeper to meet any advance that might come toward any point east of the Blue Ridge. It was a risky strategy for Lee, and he could only hope that should a major threat suddenly develop, he could unite the two wings of his army in time to confront it. He had one distinct advantage. Until now, the Union commanders had shown little ability or talent for launching any kind of rapid attack. After Antietam, when McClellan crossed the Potomac River, he seemed to pause, as though hesitant to confront Lee again so quickly. Though he continued to exude a boastful confidence, in Washington it was apparent that McClellan had no real plan for what to do next. As the autumn months passed toward winter, the Federal troops were camped over a broad area that stretched for 20 miles, from the rail lines west of Manassas Junction down through Warrenton. It was entirely possible that McClellan could have launched a major campaign against either wing of Lee's army and would have gone into either fight with overwhelming superiority. But McClellan seemed to know that his days in command were numbered. He was right. The official notice came to his camp on November 7, 1862, notifying McClellan that he had been relieved of his responsibilities with the Army of the Potomac, and, to the surprise of many of his senior commanders, his replacement was Ambrose Burnside. The new commander had been handed the same resources as McClellan, but unlike the bombastic John Pope, Burnside would not make broad pronouncements without first consulting the War Department. He was generally well-liked, had a genial personality, and seemed to be a man intent on pleasing everyone. At the moment, the people he most needed to please were in Washington. It was unlikely that his first order of business would be to throw his army right into a full-scale confrontation. Though Abraham Lincoln hoped that the new commander would actually use the vast resources available in the Union Army, Halleck and Stanton felt as Burnside did, that perhaps the war could be won without another costly battle. His plan took root in the same strategy that had driven the Union commanders since the start of the war. Capture Richmond. It was a philosophy as old as warfare itself, that if the enemy's capital falls, the war simply ends. As rapidly as possible, Burnside would gather his troops, and before Lee could respond effectively, the Federal Army would drive directly toward Richmond. The defenses there would be no match for such an overwhelming force, and with Lee's army still in the distance, the Confederacy would likely collapse. Burnside studied the Virginia waterways and realized that from the position of his army and his routes of supply, sooner or later he would have to cross the Rappahannock River. The river was navigable below Fredericksburg, which meant it was subject to tide changes, a possible disadvantage to moving an entire army across in a timely way.
The river could also be patrolled by rebel artillery batteries and cavalry, which could make any crossing considerably dangerous.
Fredericksburg stood out for other reasons as well. As the largest city between Washington and Richmond, it was an important rail crossing and the intersection of a network of good roads that spread out into central Virginia. Even though winter was fast wrapping itself around both armies, Burnside was quite sensitive to both Lincoln's and the public's criticism toward McClellan's amazing talent for delay. Burnside could not even consider ordering his army to wait until spring. If Burnside was to have his opportunity, there would be no pause, and his army would push across the river at a place where Lee would certainly not expect, directly into Fredericksburg itself. But there was one detail over which Burnside had no control. The Rappahannock River at Fredericksburg was approximately 400 feet wide, and the bridges there had been burned, a precaution taken long ago by Lee's army. In order to move his powerful force into position for their final thrust toward Richmond, Burnside would have to supply his own bridges, fashioned out of pontoons. Burnside was told by General Henry Halleck that by the time Burnside's men reached the banks of the Rappahannock opposite the city, they would receive all the pontoons they needed. By mid-November, Burnside's army, nearly 120,000 men, began their march southward. Their commander had every reason to feel the euphoric optimism that finally the Army of the Potomac had a plan that would work. On November 17th, Burnside's troops reached Falmouth, Virginia, a small town just upriver, across from Fredericksburg. As Burnside had hoped, Fredericksburg was virtually undefended by Lee's army. The Federal troops were in position to make their crossing unmolested. So far, his plan was working perfectly. There was just one problem. The pontoon bridges had not yet arrived. Assured by Halleck that the pontoons would be delivered at any time, Burnside could do nothing but gaze across helplessly at the church steeples in Fredericksburg. His subordinate commanders were as frustrated as he was, and some began to seek the means to cross the river on their own. Though shallow fords existed upriver, Burnside ordered against any smaller excursions, fearing that with the unpredictability of the winter weather, should the river suddenly rise, there was danger that a regiment, or possibly an entire division, might find itself stranded on the far side. As well, Burnside felt that his plan was cast into stone, that the War Department would be impatient with any sudden changes. For 10 days, the Union troops sat idly beside the Rappahannock, until finally, on November 27th, the pontoons arrived. Despite the breathless relief in Burnside's headquarters, one key element of his plan had now disappeared. Surprise. Though Burnside's move to Fredericksburg had indeed surprised Lee, with the delay, Lee could now respond. Word had gone out to both wings of Lee's army, and as Burnside's delay grew longer, Longstreet's corps had begun to arrive, occupying the hills just to the west of town. Jackson was on his way as well, Lee growing increasingly certain that Burnside had shown his hand, that the Federal Army was not simply feigning the move to cross at Fredericksburg. Despite losing the element of surprise, Burnside still had an enormous tactical advantage. Even with the addition of Stonewall Jackson's corps, which was still on the march, Lee had fewer than 80,000 men to confront a Union army half again as large.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?